nomination. By the same token, the very concept of superdelegates runs counter to the egalitarian core of the Charter, which strives to ensure all members of the Democratic Party full, timely, and equal opportunities to participate in decisions concerning the selection of candidates, the formulation of policy, and the conduct of other party affairs. What could be less equal, vis-a-vis the participation of the Democratic Party membership, than allotting 15% of the delegates to party elites? By the time Bernie Sanders announced his candidacy, the charter of the Democratic Party was a dead letter, at least insofar as its guiding principles are concerned. As an independent in a two-party duopoly, Sanders' progressive candidacy necessarily had to go through the Democratic nominating process to avoid being labeled a wasted third-party vote, a la Ralph Nader in 2000, from the get-go. But upon entering the process, Sanders confronted a system that had been designed with the very goal of rejecting candidacies such as his. In Act One, we explored how the DNC and Hillary Clinton campaign crafted a comprehensive media strategy to elevate Clinton to the nomination, even before Sanders had entered the race. This strategy assured Clinton of winning the crucial invisible primary, so that Sanders' chances were effectively doomed even before the first voters cast their ballots in Iowa and New Hampshire. It would be an oversimplification, however, to reduce those forces aligned against Sanders to the most visible phenomena, that is, those which operate through the world of possibilities created by the mainstream media. The media's role is as much to present possibilities to the population as it is to justify what has already been decided. In the case of Sanders, the DNC had already negated the possibility of his campaign in 1982 when it adopted the superdelegate system, a system adopted precisely to preclude a progressive grassroots candidate like McGovern from ever again capturing the nomination. From that point forward, and in direct conflict with its embrace of broad-based participation and role as neutral arbiter of the process under the terms of its own charter, the DNC committed itself, above all, to winning. And winning, in the minds of the party leadership, meant excluding the possibility of nominating a grassroots progressive. As such, when high-level DNC officials, such as Donna Brazile and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, repeatedly and blatantly transgressed their obligation to be impartial and even-handed by advancing Hillary Clinton's campaign at every turn, they were acting in a manner fully consistent with the DNC's understanding of its own mission, at least as it has existed since the adoption of superdelegates in 1982. They were, in fact, marching in lockstep with the 571 superdelegates who, it was announced by the Associated Press late in the evening on June 6, 2016, had publicly committed their support to Clinton. These superdelegate commitments permitted the Associated Press to announce that Clinton had taken the nomination not only 7 weeks prior to the convention, but before six states, including California and New Jersey, and the District of Columbia even held their primaries. Taken together, these primaries accounted for over 17% of the unpledged delegates. As the Washington Post put it, the Associated Press was thereby empowered to call the race for Hillary Clinton when nobody was looking. One could say that the superdelegates had admirably performed their function of allowing the party elites to regain control of the nomination. One might protest, as some have, that Sanders' plight cannot be laid at the feet of the superdelegates, for the simple reason that because Clinton received more pledged delegates than Sanders, she would have taken the nomination even without the superdelegates' overwhelming support. No doubt, such reasoning is tempting for those looking to salvage any shred of propriety from the results of the 2016 nominating process. It is a myopic point of view, however. Simply counting the delegate votes neglects to consider the role of superdelegates within the larger context of the nominating process. It fails to appreciate the critical role of superdelegates in allowing elites to maintain control over the process while perpetuating the myth of fair and inclusive primary elections. Consider the fact that there is nothing preventing the DNC from setting the total number of superdelegates as any percentage of the total number of delegates it wishes. The Hunt Commission originally proposed that 30% of the total delegates be superdelegates, before the DNC settled on 14% for the 1984 election. But making the number of superdelegates too great runs the risk of sapping vitality out of the primaries, thereby stripping out the legitimacy that these contests are supposed to confer upon the ultimate nominee. Recall that the 20th century movement to reform the nominating process began with Humphrey's loss to Nixon in 1968, and the view that the nominee had to emerge from a broadly participatory series of primaries and caucuses to facilitate success in the general election. Once it came into being through the McGovern-Fraser Commission, and subsequent shift to primaries by most states, the modern primary system, to thrive, has required the participation of voters operating on the belief their votes actually make a difference in selecting the nominee. The fact that superdelegates are 15% of the total delegates, as opposed to 30%, 50%, or even more, might best be explained as a balancing act for the Democratic Party. The number must be high enough to provide them with control over the nomination, but low enough to maximize voter participation in the primaries. While attempting this balancing act, the superdelegate system proved to be potent in accomplishing its objective against Sanders in 2016. As we have seen, the DNC exercised control over the nomination in no small part when, in conjunction with the Clinton campaign, it implemented a media strategy that blacked out coverage of Sanders during the invisible primary, crippling Sanders with respect to the most salient indicator of which candidate ultimately wins the nomination. When the mainstream media did mention Sanders, it was within the narrative of being the likely loser. The superdelegates played an integral role in framing the guiding trope of Clinton's invincibility. For example, Newsweek reported in October 2015, months before Iowa and New Hampshire, that Clinton had already received the support of more than half of the superdelegates. The article stated, as fact, that the backing gives her a commanding advantage over her two rivals. Of course, Newsweek made no mention of Sanders' enormous rallies or extraordinary fundraising prowess, which by November 2015 were already on full display. As it was, the article barely distinguished between Sanders and Martin O'Malley's standing vis-à-vis Clinton. Moreover, whatever implications the public might have drawn from the visible manifestations of Sanders' burgeoning support base would be nullified, in due course, by the rigidification of Clinton's inevitability as the chosen nominee in the prevailing media narrative. The role of the superdelegates in forging Clinton's inevitability cannot be understated, and reached its apex when, on June 6, 2016, the Associated Press announced Clinton as the nominee based on its internal survey of their commitments, and in doing so, effectively preempted the results of 9 yet-to-be-decided primaries and caucuses, including the largest, California, representing some 781 pledged delegates. The AP's announcement reflects an extraordinary moment in the history of the Democratic nominating process, a moment when the hitherto poorly understood power of the superdelegates revealed itself for all to see. For when the Associated Press bestowed the nomination on Clinton based on a survey of superdelegate commitments, it is as if the superdelegates held their own primary for purposes of awarding Clinton the nomination in advance of the primaries still to be held, not to mention the convention. It was a very public flex of muscle from a political body, the cadre of superdelegates, that had previously operated under a cloak of obscurity. Of course, despite the DNC's resounding success in implementing its anti-McGovern strategy against Sanders, it did not result in producing a winning candidate. Hillary Clinton did not go on to win the general election, meaning that she suffered the same fate as Humphrey, McGovern, and Carter, whose so-called weak candidacies gave rise to the McGovern, Fraser, and Hunt commissions, culminating in the introduction of superdelegates. But from the perspective of its elite participants, the 2016 Democratic primaries were a success. In terms of voter participation, They engendered enough enthusiasm to produce the second highest voter turnout in 28 years, second only to 2008 and the primaries that Barack Obama ultimately won. From a business standpoint, the primaries were undoubtedly wildly successful. According to one estimate, approximately $445 million was spent on the Democratic primaries alone. This includes money spent by the Clinton, Sanders, and O'Malley campaigns, as well as their allied super PACs and other groups. The flow of money meant ample funding for the world in which the political elites reside, the world of political consultants, lobbyists, strategists, media brokers, and the like. A not insignificant chunk of this funding came from the $228 million raised by the Sanders campaign through small donor donations. One company alone, Old Town Media, LLC, billed the Sanders campaign over $82 million to procure media advertising. No doubt, the Sanders campaign resulted in significant paydays for numerous members of the political elite class. It is even fair to say that from a fiscal perspective, the DNC emerged from the 2016 election in a historically favorable position. With $10.8 million in cash on hand and just $3.7 million in debt at the close of January 2017. One report attributed the DNC's financial health to a deal previously struck with the Clinton campaign, which had insisted that the DNC set aside $10 million for purposes of strengthening the party apparatus during her anticipated presidency. To appreciate the truth of the financial relationship between the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC, however, one needs to recognize that the word deal is something of a misnomer in this context. Owing to the Hillary Victory Fund, a species of election law entity known as a joint fundraising committee, the finances of the DNC and Clinton campaign were intimately intertwined throughout the entire election season. Comprehending the nature of this arrangement is, in fact, critical to understanding what the DNC and Democratic Party truly embody, behind the lofty proclamations of the charter and bylaws, and even the not-so-lofty rules of the superdelegate system. Per federal election law, a joint fundraising committee is a legal entity established to facilitate joint election-related fundraising efforts conducted among party organizations, non-party organizations, and candidates. As a joint fundraising committee, the Hillary Victory Fund enabled the Clinton campaign, DNC, and 38 state Democratic Party committees to collectively raise over $529 million during the 2015-16 campaign cycle. Its legal structure allowed the Hillary Victory Fund to solicit donations of up to $418,800 from the super wealthy by aggregating the limits on donations to political campaigns, $2,700 per election. A national party committee such as the DNC, $33,400 per year, and state party committees, $10,000 per year. Some of the Hillary Victory Fund's half-billion-dollar-plus haul came from parties hosted by the likes of actor George Clooney and media mogul Jeffrey Katzenberg. At one Clooney fundraiser, two seats at the head table with Hillary Clinton had a price tag of $353,000. Two Clooney-hosted fundraisers in California raised over $15 million on their own. The Hillary Victory Fund was pitched to the public as a fundraising tool for electing Democrats to Congress. Confronted with accusations of being a corporate shill, Clooney replied that the overwhelming amount of the money that we're raising is not going to Hillary to run for president. It's going to the down ticket. But this was flatly untrue. While $112.4 million did go to state party accounts, 78.5% of that amount, or $88.3 million, was then transferred to the DNC. This massive shift of dollars from the state parties to the DNC was made possible by the lack of any legal limitation on how much money may be transferred between and among state, local, and national party committees. Thus, at its essence, the Hillary Victory Fund was a vehicle for maximizing the flow of money from wealthy donors to the DNC, an organization which, we have seen, was fully committed to elevating Hillary Clinton to the nomination even before Bernie Sanders entered the race. The DNC's putative role as neutral arbiter of the primary process, supposedly bound by its own charter to treat all candidates with impartiality and even-handedness, is perhaps nowhere more starkly exposed as fiction than through the dynamics of the Hillary Victory Fund. The very wherewithal of the DNC, to the tune of over $88 million, depended on Hillary Clinton's ability to raise funds through the Hillary Victory Fund. Given this dependency, the concept that the DNC would or could act neutrally in the primaries simply defies basic common sense. In critical respects, the Hillary Victory Fund, with its sharply drawn lines of fealty running from the DNC's coffers to the Clinton campaign's fundraising prowess, is the actual blueprint for the DNC's structure as it exists in the present day. This legal entity, through which the DNC's financial well-being was tethered to the ability of the Clinton campaign to attract outsized checks from ultra-wealthy donors at lavish fundraisers, is much more revelatory of the DNC's institutional logic than the charter or bylaws, or for that matter, even the system of superdelegates adopted in 1982. In fact, it is hardly a stretch to suggest that the Hillary Victory Fund explains better than any other factor, including the historical mandate for superdelegates to protect against reincarnations of McGovern, such as Sanders, the unyielding loyalty of the vast majority of superdelegates to Clinton in 2016. To wit, once the DNC and the state parties partnered with the Clinton campaign on their half-billion-dollar-plus fundraising venture, the commitment of the party elites to vote for Clinton was at least tacit, if not express. The intersection of the superdelegate system with the financial potentiality embodied in the Hillary Victory Fund represented a hitherto unseen alignment of forces in American politics that ensured the impossibility of Sanders obtaining the nomination. As we have seen, when the superdelegate system was adopted in 1982, it was in direct response to a series of perceived weak candidacies, and with a pronounced desire to get the Democratic Party back into the business of winning. But those sentiments grew out of a different era in American politics, one which had not yet succumbed to the logic of virtually unrestricted campaign financing. As much, or perhaps even more than any factor, the latter has molded the DNC's institutional logic, which manifested in a single-minded determination to elevate Clinton, whose campaign, it cannot be overemphasized, enriched the DNC to the tune of $88.3 million via the Hillary Victory Fund. As we have seen, from a constitutional point of view, the two-party duopoly is an interloper to our system of government. The Founding Fathers would have viewed the concept of popularly based parties with great skepticism. Nonetheless, in decisions such as Timmins, the domination of electoral politics by the Democrats and Republicans has been afforded a constitutionally protected status by the Supreme Court. The Court has not only accorded recognition to this political duopoly, but also played a vital role in perpetuating its existence. Most significantly, via the establishment and maintenance of an election law framework, within which constructs such as the Hillary Victory Fund are enabled and then encouraged to prosper. Even before the DNC adopted the superdelegate system to squash the possibility of McGovern's reincarnation, the Supreme Court was already pouring the legal foundation for the Hillary Victory Fund. In 1976, just over 3 years after McGovern lost the general election to Nixon, the court decided Buckley v. Vallejo, a case that would pave the way for unlimited spending as a feature of U.S. political campaigns. In Buckley, the court struck down Congress's attempt to place caps on the amount of money that may be spent in support of a political campaign, by most individuals and groups outside of the candidate and political parties, as unconstitutional restrictions on the freedom of expression. In a complex and at times impenetrable opinion, the court held there could be no such limits on campaign spending, even though Congress had found them necessary as part of a comprehensive package of election reforms passed to prevent the kinds of egregious campaign finance abuses and corruption that had recently come to light with the events known as Watergate. The court found that the potential to limit the First Amendment rights of those who want to spend money on political campaigns was too important, and the governmental interest in preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption too trivial to justify any ceilings on how much they could spend. Two features of this head-scratching but highly influential opinion are especially worth noting. First, the court cites no real precedent for the proposition that spending money on a political campaign is equivalent to what we normally think of as speech or expression as protected by the First Amendment. Instead, it simply assumes they are one and the same thing based on the observation that virtually every means of communicating ideas in today's mass society requires the expenditure of money. In so doing, the court posits a direct equivalence between the spending of money and the exercise of free expression, a bizarre proposition that would come to haunt our political system up through the present. The Buckley Court's equivalence of money with speech rests on the assumption that the means of producing expression are equivalent to expression itself. In other words, because money buys the means of expression, money equals expression. But only 8 years earlier, in United States v. O'Brien, the Supreme Court had rather forcefully rejected the thrust of this general proposition, when it found no constitutional barrier to sentencing David Paul O'Brien to prison for the crime of burning his Selective Service Registration Certificate in protest of the Vietnam War and draft. The O'Brien court was openly scornful of the idea that burning a draft card could be protected as speech, in and of itself, proclaiming that, "We cannot accept the view that an apparently limitless variety of conduct can be labeled speech whenever the person engaging in the conduct intends thereby to express an idea." When, in Buckley, the Supreme Court embraced the notion that the means of expression are equivalent to expression itself, it did exactly what it said it would never do in O'Brien. The court thereby adopted a point of view by which an apparently limitless variety of conduct can be labeled as speech. The act of cutting a check constitutes speech, per Buckley, because the act causes speech to occur. But this is basically the same argument O'Brien had made to the court about the burning of his draft card as a form of protest. The act of destroying a draft card should not be criminalized, he argued, because to do so is to punish an act that causes expression to occur, that is, a message of protest against Vietnam. The O'Brien court derided this argument as limitless and rejected it out of hand. Unfortunately, Buckley is just one example of the Supreme Court's general tendency to ignore precedent, or even reverse itself, whenever there are entrenched corporate interests in need of protection, a tendency that has only gotten more acute in recent years. Like the equivalence of money with speech, a second troubling aspect of Buckley would come to play a formative role in the structuring of campaign finance law down the road. This is the Supreme Court's discussion of what constitutes corruption sufficient for Congress to stanch the flow of money into politics. Whereas Buckley finds the government's interest in preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption to be inadequate for the purpose of supporting caps on independent expenditures on campaigns, in the same opinion, the court states that limiting the actuality and appearance of corruption resulting from individual financial contributions to campaigns is sufficient to justify imposing limitations on the size of donations to candidates. In this portion of the opinion, the court proclaims itself to be well aware of the danger of actual quid pro quo arrangements alongside the impact of the appearance of corruption stemming from public awareness of the opportunities for abuse inherent in a regime of large individual financial contributions. The weighty interests presented by the need to forestall corruption are served, according to Buckley, by limiting how much one can donate to a political campaign. And yet when it comes to independent expenditures, the court is unwilling to concede that the same weighty interests apply. Instead, the court takes solace in the notion that because such expenditures are made totally independently of the candidate and his campaign, there is little danger that expenditures will be given as a quid pro quo for improper commitments from the candidates. Accordingly, Buckley exists within a framework where politicians may only be improperly influenced or bought via donations directly to their campaigns. But if the same money is spent independently on the same candidate and campaign, the potential for undue influence miraculously fades away. The distinction is hopelessly formalistic, naive, and out of touch with the common-sense reality of how influence is actually exerted on politicians outside of direct quid pro quo arrangements. As a consequence, Buckley also stands for a ludicrously narrow conception of what entails corruption, necessary to justify regulating the transfer of money relating to political activity. Unfortunately, like the false equivalence between money and speech, the Buckley Court's simplistic reduction of corruption to quid pro quo arrangements ended up permanently infecting the body of American campaign finance jurisprudence. By the time Bernie Sanders announced his candidacy, the seeds planted in Buckley had germinated into two distinct species of political fundraising juggernaut. One, the super PAC, capable of raising unlimited sums from corporations for independent expenditures. And two, the Joint Fundraising Committee, which in the case of the Hillary Victory Fund, pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into the coffers of the Clinton campaign and the DNC. These formidable creatures owed their existence to Supreme Court decisions, pushing the absurd and simplistic reasoning of Buckley to generate more outrageous conclusions. In 2010, the court decided Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission, where it went out of its way to rule that corporations cannot be stopped from making unlimited independent expenditures on political campaigns. In removing any limitations on what it referred to as corporate speech, the court hammered home Buckley's cabining of corruption to quid pro quo arrangements, noting that the hallmark of corruption is the financial quid pro quo, dollars for political favors. With Citizens United, the Supreme Court laid the vital groundwork for what has become known as the super PAC, fundraising committees which can raise unlimited amounts of cash from corporations, as well as unions, associations, and individuals, for independent expenditures on campaigns. Super PACs provided formidable support to Clinton's candidacy in 2016, with the largest, Priorities USA Action, taking in over $175 million and spending over $161 million to advance Clinton's candidacy. By contrast, the largest super PAC supporting Sanders, whose campaign repeatedly attacked the concept of super PACs, National Nurses United for Patient Protection, raised $8.1 million. The same myopic view of what constitutes corruption found in Buckley and Citizens United animates McCutcheon v. Federal Election Commission, the 2014 Supreme Court decision to which the Hillary Victory Fund owed its existence. In striking down aggregate limits on how much donors can contribute in total to all candidate or party committees in an election cycle, the court reiterated its view that the government lacks authority to combat corruption, defined as anything other than actual quid pro quo arrangements. In reaching the conclusion that aggregate limits can serve no role combating corruption so narrowly defined, the court specifically rejected an example presented by the lower court whose judgment McCutcheon overturned, whereby a donor gives a $500,000 check to a joint fundraising committee composed of a candidate, a national party committee, and most of the party's state party committees. The committees divide up the money so that each one receives the maximum contribution permissible under the base limits, but then each transfers its allocated portion to the same single committee. That committee uses the money for coordinated expenditures on behalf of a particular candidate. This arrangement describes the Hillary Victory Fund practically to the letter, and yet the Supreme Court, writing just 17 months before the fund filed its statement of organization with the Federal Election Commission, views its possibility as unlikely and based on speculation. Either the justices comprising the majority in McCutcheon lack the most basic understanding of the practical implications of their judicial decision-making, or their words are disingenuous. In a post-election public appearance, Hillary Clinton had this to say about her relationship to the Democratic Party and DNC during the campaign. "I inherited nothing from the Democratic Party. I mean, it was bankrupt. It was on the verge of insolvency. Its data was mediocre to poor, non-existent, wrong. I had to inject money into it, the DNC, to keep it going. It seems odd, laughable even, to characterize an organization which advanced Clinton's candidacy at every turn, including by raising over $500 million through the Hillary Victory Fund, as bankrupt and a source of nothing. Some might call her remarks ungracious. And yet, Clinton's cutting view of the DNC and its relationship to her campaign reveal painful truths about the state of our political system. The DNC is indeed bankrupt, though not in the sense of being unable to pay its debts. To be sure, the Supreme Court's campaign finance jurisprudence has virtually guaranteed the DNC's continued financial solvency as a potent fundraising arm for its chosen candidate. Rather, the DNC is a broken organization, broken away from its purpose as a site of democratic engagement and popular participation as set forth in the Charter. The DNC is unable to perform the task to which it has committed itself, because it exists within a political system that will not allow it to do so. Our laws, speaking through the Supreme Court, have endowed the payment of money by corporations, not individual citizen engagement or even voting, as the quintessential form of political participation in America. Witness the Supreme Court's view, as expressed in Citizens United, that the voices of corporations best represent the most significant segments of the economy. According to the court, corporations are the best equipped to influence the nation's policy, and the fact that one who spends large sums may garner influence over or even access to elected officials or political parties entails neither corruption nor the appearance of corruption. The system that confronted Bernie Sanders in 2016 is one constructed over many years to prevent candidates like Sanders from becoming president. The impossibility of Sanders' candidacy has become ingrained in the law. From the two-party duopoly, to the DNC's superdelegate system, to campaign financing awash in unlimited corporate money, the law has embraced a view of governance based on the primacy of entrenched corporate interests. Thanks to Sanders' candidacy, the contours of that system have now become clear to anyone willing to open their eyes and look. However, the consequences of this knowledge, both positive and normative, have yet to be determined. Summation. Rule of law demands consequences. Democracy demands the truth so people can make intelligent decisions. Judge Locke's parting words at the hearing held on April 25, 2017, ring in my ears from time to time. One of those times occurred on the day Politico released an excerpt from Donna Brazile's forthcoming memoir on the 2016 election, in which she acknowledges that the DNC rigged the system to throw the primary to Hillary. According to Brazil, the Clinton campaign had control of the party before the voters had decided which one they wanted to lead. Brazil said this became apparent to her when she found a funding arrangement between the Hillary Clinton campaign and the DNC after she became interim DNC chair. The funding arrangement, which was not publicly available until Brazil's book excerpt was released, specified that as of September 25, 2015, and in consideration for the Clinton campaign's fundraising efforts on behalf of the DNC through the Hillary Victory Fund Joint Fundraising Committee, the Clinton campaign would exercise control over all strategic decisions at the DNC, as well as hiring and the money raised. Prior to Brazil's revelation, publicly available information had already shown the dynamics of the Hillary Victory Fund to have destroyed any possible pretense of the DNC to being a neutral arbiter of the primaries. But now there is further, direct, smoking gun evidence that the primaries were rigged, and Bernie Sanders never had a shot. This latest information from Brazil connects the dots financially, from the Clinton campaign's coffers to the very identity of the DNC, in both its personnel and ability to make decisions. It is, in fact, just the kind of critical evidence we, as plaintiff's lawyers, would hope to unearth in discovery and offer a trial, along with Brazil's statements that after assuming the reins of the DNC, she was told by the Clinton campaign's CFO that the DNC was fully under the control of Hillary's campaign, and being deployed as little more than a tool to maximize donations to the Clinton campaign through the Hillary Victory Fund. Indeed, evidence such as the fundraising arrangement between the Clinton campaign and the DNC might make the centerpiece of our opening and closing statements to the jury, but for the fact that our lawsuit may never see a trial. On August 25, 2017, Judge Zlock dismissed the case, holding that none of the plaintiffs, including donors to the Sanders campaign, have standing to pursue legal action against the DNC or Wasserman Schultz, based on claims that the primary was rigged. It must be noted, his order went out of its way to reject the defendants' characterization of their duty to be impartial and even-handed under the Charter as a trivialization of the DNC's governing principles, and found that the DNC, through its charter, has committed itself to a higher principle. At the same time, the order echoed Spiva's caution that the court not wade into the political thicket, concluding that the choice and attendant consequences between impartiality and even-handedness and Tammany Hall politics lies in the province of the DNC, not the judiciary. The case is now on appeal with the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia. As a lawyer, I have good reason to be pessimistic about our chances. In federal civil cases, appeals are successful only about 3-4% of the time. While I am confident in the strength of the arguments we will be presenting in the appellate court, I have no illusions about the chances being slim of our legal complaint not turning out to be one of many that were germinated by the events of U.S. elections, yet will ultimately fail to bear legal fruit. Of course, our prosecution of the DNC fraud lawsuit was never about legal fruit to begin with. It started with our abiding faith in Bernie Sanders' candidacy, with our belief that Sanders could prevail in the Democratic primaries. It stemmed from our faith in the democratic character of America's electoral institutions. From the standpoint of one who maintains this latter type of faith, perhaps the situation is not so bleak. Some have argued that in terms of the statements made by the DNC's counsel in a federal court, the lawsuit has already been substantially revelatory in terms of what it has disclosed about the Democratic Party, its self-image, and operational structure. From this perspective, the lawsuit has already accomplished one of the legal system's aims, to bring truth into the light of day. The great justice, Louis D. Brandeis, who served on the nation's highest bench from 1916 to 1939, famously observed that sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants. If you ascribe to this view, then you might agree that Wilding helped bring sunlight upon the workings of the DNC regarding the primary, which is what must happen to genuinely reform the Democratic Party. Per Justice Brandeis, knowledge by the general public of governmental corruption is a predicate to any movement for remedial action. But I wonder about the relevance of Justice Brandeis's old quip. For one, sunlight is not actually the best disinfectant. The natural disinfectant properties of sunshine are quite limited, in fact. Sunlight is most effective against waterborne pathogens only, has no effect on chemical contaminants like lead or toxic pollutants, and should be deployed only where more complex forms of water purification are less accessible. There is not sufficient ultraviolet light in the sun's rays to disinfect a cell phone left in the sun all afternoon. These concerns pose no mere rhetorical quibble with Justice Brandeis. What if the strain of corruption that has contaminated America's democratic institutions, which corruption produced the very forces that precluded Sanders from having a chance to gain the nomination, is so virulent that sunlight, in the form of public knowledge, is incapable of providing meaningful decontamination? Justice Brandeis's formulation depends upon the view that the nation's democratic institutions are at a certain level of vitality, strong enough to translate the people's desire for change into governmental reform. but are they? Another quotation is frequently attributed to Justice Brandeis. We can have a democratic society, or we can have the concentration of great wealth in the hands of a few. We cannot have both. Ralph Nader invoked these words at the outset of the 2000 presidential campaign, where he was on the Green Party ballot. Perhaps the truth of Brandeis's later observation negates any wisdom clinging to his aphorism regarding sunlight. If so, the enormous concentration of wealth in American society in so few hands, which was the very impetus for Bernie Sanders' candidacy, as well as the genesis of those political forces which conspired to defeat his candidacy, means that Americans are not entitled to regard themselves as citizens of a democratic society. The signs have been in plain sight for a long time. In the first three chapters of this book alone, in seeking to explain why it was impossible for a candidate like Bernie Sanders to win the 2016 nomination, I have already cited the words of three prominent figures in American politics or political thought, who have, at various times, characterized U.S. political institutions as essentially oligarchic. Walter Dean Burnham, Richard Posner, and Sanders himself. They are not alone. In 2009, two professors of political science at Northwestern University, Jeffrey A. Winters and Benjamin I. Page, published a paper concluding that it is useful to think about the U.S. political system in terms of oligarchy. 5 years later, Page and another political scientist, Martin Gillens of Princeton, published an exhaustive, data-driven analysis concluding that the wealthy few move policy, while the average American has little power. In 2013, Harvard Law School professor Lawrence Lessig and, for a brief period, candidate for the 2016 Democratic Party nomination, gave a TED Talk in which he described the United States as Lesterland, where candidates for Congress are dependent on 0.5% of the population, that is, their campaign funders. Ron Formisano, chair of the American History Department at the University of Kentucky, puts it bluntly in the title of his latest book, released this past year, American Oligarchy, the Permanent Political Class. Isn't it time we faced the fact that the United States is an oligarchy? Or, as Winters and Page suggest, grapple with the normative implications of this truth? In embarking on the task, however, let us not lose sight of the daring implications. Indeed, the Supreme Court has ruled the statement, American democracy is a fraud, to be not generally accepted and distasteful to most of us. And the concept of American democracy is central not only to the nation's self-image, but its official orientation to the rest of the world, which purports to originate in an understanding that democracy and respect for human rights have long been central components of U.S. foreign policy. Supporting democracy not only promotes such fundamental American values as religious freedom and worker rights, but also helps create a more secure, stable, and prosperous global arena in which the United States can advance its national interests. In addition, democracy is the one national interest that helps to secure all the others. Democratically governed nations are more likely to secure the peace, deter aggression, expand open markets, promote economic development, protect American citizens, combat international terrorism and crime, uphold human and worker rights, avoid humanitarian crises and refugee flows, improve the global environment, and protect human health. As Plato writes in The Republic, the acquisition of knowledge about the world can cause both agony and disorientation. The prisoner, freed from his chains in the cave and turning toward the sunlight outside, is pained and dazzled and unable to see the things whose shadows he'd seen before. Plato and Aristotle had much to say about oligarchy and democracy. Greeks of their time were intimately familiar with both forms of government. The political understanding of their time was indelibly infused by the variety of regimes that could be supported through the vehicle of the emerging, independent Greek city-state. In Plato's famous ranking of political regimes, found in Book 8 of the Republic, oligarchy is third best, while democracy comes fourth. First is the Kallipolis, or beautiful city, ruled by philosopher kings, while the second best regime is timocracy, ruled by property owners. The worst regime, according to Plato, is tyranny. In truth, however, oligarchies and democracies seem like equally bleak places to live in Plato's account. Oligarchies are characterized by the pursuit of wealth above all else, while democracies value the pursuit of what Plato calls eleutheria, translated as freedom or liberty, to the point of threatening law and order. Of course, Plato was not so much concerned with painting a nuanced portrait of political life under any of the five regimes, as seeking to distill certain core truths present in each of them. Aristotle, who was much more interested than his teacher in philosophizing about the world as is, broadly defined democracy as when the free and poor, being a majority, have authority to rule. Oligarchy, when the wealthy and better born have authority and are few. Within these broad categories, there are many varieties of democracy and oligarchy, depending on such factors as which segments of the population can hold office, and whether the rule of law governs. The rule of law is especially significant for Aristotle, because its absence is characteristic of the worst varieties of both democracy and oligarchy. For in cities under a democracy that is based on law, a popular leader does not arise, but the best of the citizens preside. But where the laws are without authority, there popular leaders arise. The result is a kind of tyranny of the mob. At the same time, an oligarchy without law is an equally tyrannical regime, what Aristotle refers to as dynastia, dynasty. The import of rule of law is of a piece with Aristotle's moral philosophy, in which he ascribes a critical role to the rule of law in cultivating individual virtue. Perhaps Aristotle's reverence for law reflects his teacher, as Plato devoted a considerable amount of his own output to the subject. Before going any further into the normative implications of living under an oligarchy, it must be noted, then, that for Aristotle at least, there is an even more fundamental question: whether or not rule of law is being enforced. As an attorney who, it should be apparent by now, has grown increasingly disenchanted with the functioning of the American legal system, this is not an altogether settling prospect. As counsel to the plaintiffs in the DNC fraud lawsuit, it is even less settling. Recall that in open court, the DNC's lawyer, Bruce Spivor, compared his client's charter obligation to be impartial and even-handed as akin to a mere political promise, unenforceable in a court of law. Judge Locke rejected this as a trivialization of the DNC's governing principles, finding that the DNC, through its charter, has committed itself to a higher principle. Nonetheless, he held that the plaintiffs lack standing to enforce the DNC's commitment. And more recently, the DNC's former chair, Donna Brazile, while acknowledging in one breath that the primaries were in fact rigged, has insisted that the rigging, although potentially unethical, was not illegal. Together, these propositions constitute more than a mounting pile of evidence that the rule of law is in serious jeopardy. Those of us who have closely followed the trials and tribulations of Bernie Sanders' ill-fated campaign have seen a whole raft of blatant election law violations go unpunished. Meanwhile, those who have studied Hillary Clinton, either as a candidate or in her prior political life, cannot seriously have failed to detect a pattern of investigation upon investigation, all failing to bear legal fruit. Indeed, on July 5, 2016, the frailty of American rule of law was nakedly on public display. On that morning, the nation's top legal enforcement officer, Director of the FBI James Comey, announced the conclusion of his agency's year-long investigation of Clinton's unauthorized use of a private email server while Secretary of State, with the determination that while her conduct had been extremely careless, no criminal prosecution was warranted. From a legal standpoint, the trouble with Comey's statement was that extremely careless behavior appears to be coextensive with the level of conduct required to support a violation of the relevant statute, 18 U.S.C. 793F, a provision of the Espionage Act, which criminalizes gross negligence in connection with documents relating to the national defense. While Comey pronounced that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case, the proposition is contradicted by a history of Espionage Act prosecutions under the gross negligence standard successfully pursued in the United States military courts. The fruitless email investigation was not the only criminal inquest into Clinton's dealings undertaken during the 2016 campaign season. A corruption investigation into the Clinton Foundation spanning multiple FBI offices failed to spur any legal process by the Department of Justice. Investigators also dogged the DNC's former chair, Wasserman Schultz, in connection with procurement and data transfer irregularities traced to a group of House IT network workers, which included one of her employees. At a hearing of the House Appropriations Subcommittee, Wasserman Schultz advised the chief of Capitol Police that there would be consequences if the police did not return her laptop taken as part of the investigation. As of the writing of this book, the investigation has resulted in only relatively minor bank fraud charges being filed against two of the IT workers, both of whom have pled not guilty. Certainly, others have expressed alarm at the remarkable lack of will to bring public corruption prosecutions in present-day America. But the sense of lawlessness is not just an abstract feature of political life in a 21st-century polity that is increasingly oligarchical in character, if not official self-image. In her memoir, the former DNC chair conveys a creeping paranoia felt concurrently with the sense of lawlessness intruding her personal life. Brazil writes that she was haunted by the still unsolved murder of DNC data staffer Seth Rich and feared for her own life, shutting the blinds to her office window so snipers could not see her, and installing surveillance cameras at her home. She wonders whether Russians had placed a listening device in plants in the DNC executive suite. Elizabeth and I can surely relate to Brazil on this score. Seth Rich would have been a witness in our case. Seth, a data analyst at the DNC, was shot in the back in a supposed botched robbery. But all his possessions, including a wallet, watch, and phone, were found on his body. Not only does his murder remain unsolved, with hundreds of thousands of dollars in outstanding reward money, but our process server, Sean Lucas, dropped dead suddenly, before he was going to give us a sworn declaration on how he had fulfilled the service of process requirements. And we have never received a satisfactory explanation for this either. These are not the only disturbing events marring our prosecution of the lawsuit. We've received threats and other bizarre conduct directed at counsel and plaintiffs, including a voice-altered phone call received at our office that appeared to emanate from one of Wasserman Schultz's Florida offices. When things like this happen at your office, it does not help in the task of ensuring a pleasant place to work for your employees. Thankfully, our assistant, Kimberly Diaz, and associate attorney, Beverly Viruis, have been rock-solid, focused, and professional throughout. But what is perhaps even more frightening than the strange and disturbing events that happened in the course of pursuing the case is the mainstream media's almost complete lack of attention to the lawsuit. And what little it has reported invariably has placed us, our clients, and our claims in a less than serious light. Perhaps oligarchies tend more to lawlessness than other types of regimes, and this is something we Americans should become more accustomed to, as we become resigned to the true nature of our own government. Aristotle suggests as much, insofar as he notes that oligarchies are inherently less stable than democracies. The governments of oligarchies are not only subject to attack from the mass of people who are not politically empowered, but they are vulnerable to assault from other oligarchs. In such an atmosphere of instability, it is not hard to see why adherence to the rule of law takes a back seat. In Plato's bleaker account of human imperfection and inevitable decay, oligarchic man comes into being through his very disregard of the law, which eventually comes to destroy law itself. The treasure house filled with gold, which each possesses, destroys the Constitution. First, they find ways of spending money for themselves. Then they stretch the laws relating to this. Then they and their wives disobey the laws altogether. Even prior to the establishment of the Republic, America originated in a declaration of legal rights against tyranny. Given the nature of oligarchies, our modern-day regime presents unique challenges to this commitment. For those American citizens seeking to confront these challenges, what happened to Bernie Sanders suggests that we should not expect to be guided by conventional modes and manners of American citizenship. Being a passive consumer of the conventional press and regularly voting in elections as an informed citizen can no longer translate into being an informed or empowered citizen of the United States, if it ever did to begin with. In contrast, the creation and deployment of new and effective modes of engagement with those who govern us may be the existential political task of our time. Appendix 1. United States District Court, Southern District of Florida, Fort Lauderdale Division. Case number 1661511, CIV WJZ. Carol Wilding et al., plaintiffs. V. DNC Services Corp., DBA Democratic National Committee et al., defendants. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, April 25, 2017, 1:24 p.m. Transcript of motion hearing had before the Honorable William J. Zlock, United States District Judge. Proceedings recorded by mechanical stenography. Transcript produced by computer. Appearances. For the plaintiffs: Jared H. Beck, Esquire. Beverly Viruis, Esquire. Beck and Lee, P.A. 12485 Southwest 137th Avenue, Suite 205, Miami, Florida. 33186. And Cullen O'Brien, Esquire. Cullen O'Brien Law, P.A. 6541 Northeast 21st Way, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. 33308. And Antonio G. Hernandez, Esquire. Law Office of Antonio G. Hernandez. 4 Southeast 1st Street, 2nd Floor, Miami, Florida, 33131. For the defendants: Bruce V. Spiva, Esquire. Mark R. Caramanica, Esquire. Thomas and Lo Cicero. 601 South Boulevard, Tampa, Florida. 33601. Court reporter: Francine C. Salopek, RMR, CRR, Official Court Reporter, United States District Court, 299 East Broward Boulevard, Room 205F, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, 33301. 954-769-5657/MJSFCS@AOL.com. Tuesday, April 25th, 2017, 1:24 p.m. The judge entered the courtroom. The court: Good afternoon. Please be seated. Calling case number 1661511, civil. Counsel, would you note your appearances? Mr. Beck: Good morning, Your Honor. Jared Beck on behalf of the plaintiffs. Mr. O'Brien: Your Honor, Cullen O'Brien on behalf of the plaintiffs. Mr. Hernandez: Your Honor, Antonio Hernandez on behalf of the plaintiffs. Ms. Viruis: Beverly Viruis on behalf of the plaintiffs. The court: Good afternoon. Mr. Spiva: Good afternoon, Your Honor. Bruce Spiva on behalf of the defendants. Mr. Caramanica: And, Your Honor, Mark Caramanica on behalf of the defendants. The court: Good afternoon. We're here this afternoon for or upon the motion to dismiss filed by the defense. I have, obviously, questions for both sides. And what I'd like to do is, as we cover various technical issues, such as standing, the pleadings, class action allegations, and so forth, rather than hear from just one side, as we go through with individual questions, I'll hear from the defense. I'll hear from the plaintiff on that particular issue. All right? And again, these are technical issues that we will be dealing with. But let me just give a brief description of the case at this point. The plaintiffs brought this suit as a putative class action against defendants DNC Services Corp. and Deborah Wasserman Schultz. According to their first amended complaint, that is, docket entry number 8, the plaintiffs are, quote, residents of 45